Somebody complained that Aviv is not here today, so they're not going to have Parsha Shavua. So I will speak about the Parsha then more than I normally would have. In the very beginning of the Parsha, it says, Vayera Elov Hashem, Ve'elone Mamre, V'hu Yoshev Petach, Ohel Kechom Hayom. Which means God appeared to him in the plains of Mamre, and he's sitting by the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day. Vayisa Einav Vayar, he lifts up his eyes and he sees, Vihine Shlosha Nashim Nitzavim Alav, and he sees there are three men who are standing upon him. Vayar, he looks, Vayarats, he runs, Lakrotam, towards them, Mipetach Ohel, from the entrance of the tent, Vayishtachu Arza, and he bows down to the ground. Vayomer, Vayomar, and he says, Adonai, he says the word Adonai, if I have found favor in your eyes, do not go in front of your servant. So in case you're perturbed in my pronunciation of the word Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, which is written in the text like that, the Gemara in Shavuot tells us the following. This is source 2. Kol Shemot Ha'amurim B'Torah Ba'Avraham Kadosh. Every time it uses a name of God, or all the names, all the titles, in connection with Avram are holy. Chutz Mizeh Shehul Chol. Except for one which is not holy, rather it is, what's the opposite of sacred?
Profane.
Well, not profane. Profane is not good here. What?
Mundane.
Chol would be mundane. Correct. So what's the one example the Gemara tells us of a name which is used in context with Avram, which is called mundane? Vayomar Hashem alna matzati chen beinach. Now, this is very interesting, because in the Gemara over here, when it quotes the Pasuk, it put two yuds over there. So when you see two yuds, what are you convinced that it says? That it says Hashem. It means Hashem. Now the reason why this is so funny, the reason why it's so funny is that they just now said that in this instance, the word Adonai means what? My Lord. Now, my Lord could be holy. In which context would it be holy? If you're talking to God. Or it could be mundane if you're talking to somebody else. So what's the question then that exists in this verse? Who is Avram speaking to? Is Avram speaking to God when he says this, and then it's kadosh, then it's holy? Or is Avram speaking to one of the people? I know you're going to tell me they're angels, but he doesn't necessarily know that they're angels. Why? Well, I think we're trying to distance it even more. So, well, as I said, the Gemara over here, you can argue about all the diktuk that you want. It is of little concern to me. The Gemara over here has two opinions. One opinion is that this name is kadosh. Like for example, the word Elohim, one more second, the word Elohim is used multiple times in the Torah. The vast majority of times, it's holy. Every now and then, it's not holy. For example, in reference to judges, it's not holy. So over here, even regarding the word Adonai, we have a difference of opinion whether it's holy or not. Yes?
By the rest of the Pasuk, we can understand that Avraham is not talking to plural, but to singular, because it says Adonai.
Right.
He refers to somebody or Then he says, "Im namatzati chen be'enecha."
Right. Right. Right.
Which means that Adonai is also singular.
Right.
He's not talking to the three angels.
Right. So those who say that it's whole will say, those who say,
he's referring to God.
Okay. So those who say that it's whole, that it's mundane here and not holy, they would say that he's speaking to the main angel or the main person. Again, he doesn't know they're angels necessarily. He sees three people, so he speaks to the one who's standing in the center, who's flanked by the other two. Excuse me?
So why doesn't he say Adonai?
That I can't tell you, but it could be that he's giving him even more honor by using that name. Again, don't argue with me right now. I'm telling you that the Gemara has two different opinions. One opinion is that it's holy, and one opinion is that it's mundane. The Gemara continues and says, and again, I just wanted to point out the irony over here, that it does write yud-yud, and it shouldn't have in the Gemara, because it, one second, this one said it's chol. So if it's saying that it's chol, then it should not write yud-yud. It should have written the letters aleph, dalet, nun, yud in the Gemara when it quotes it. Later on, that we'll see another Gemara that quotes it, and it does the same thing, but in the other one, a note on the side of the Gemara fixes it. It says that over here, the copyist and the Gemara made a mistake. But let's continue. Chanina ben Achi Rabbi Yehoshua, v'Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, mishum Rabbi Elazar Hamodai, Amru, both of them said, af ze kadosh. So all of you who were troubled and think that it works out better if this is also kadosh, so they come to the opinion that this is kadosh in this sense. But over here, this name is also talking about God, and therefore Avraham is speaking to God over here as well. You happy now? Yes. Kiman Azla, who do they go like? Like, what does this opinion follow? Hoda Amarav, Yehuda Amarav, this fits into the opinion that Rav Yehuda taught the name of Rav, which is why we're getting here today. Gidola hachnasat orchin, yoter me hakabalat pnei shchina. And if you were in Hebrew, you would correct that as well. But that's the title that I picked for today, because that is the phrase in the Gemara, which I hope you appreciate is not pure Hebrew. That is Aramaic as well. Gidola hachnasat orchin, you would say hachnasat orchin. Yoter me hakabalat. Would you say that? You wouldn't say hakpalat. Pnei shchina. Would you say shchina or hashchina? You say shchina. So the Gemara says, kiman, who does this follow, this opinion? Ka'oto hazug, like those two people. Which two people? Chanina ben Achi Rabbi Yeshua and Elazar ben Azariah, Mishum Elazar ben Ma'i, who said kadosh. Now, let's back up a second to see what the Gemara just now did. The Gemara taught something which is really a fascinating teaching. The teaching is that hachnasat orchim, taking in guests, is more important than taking or being in the presence of God. Now, you can start arguing with me in all kinds of ways and say, well, you're always in the presence of God. And I can assure you that there are some commentators that go in that direction as well, and say that if you're just in the presence of God, then you're only in the presence of God. But if you're taking guests, then you're in the presence of God and you're in the presence of guests. But that's not what it says over here. What is this teaching predicated on? It's predicated on the following reading of the verses. Go back and look at the first source. And God appeared to Abraham, or God appeared to him in the tents of Mamre. He's sitting by the tent in the heat of the day. So over here we have a revelation. How do I know there's a revelation? It just said that, and God appeared to him. What's the content of the revelation? Because whenever you're going to have a revelation, you should have a content. Right? God appeared to Avram, and there should be something that he did or he said or something. There's no content. Then it says, he lifts up his eyes and he sees there are three men. He goes and he rushes to greet them. And then comes that important verse 3. Is he directing it back to God? Is he saying to God now, who had just appeared to him and didn't have a chance to tell him anything? And then he says to God, listen, I find favor in your eyes. Don't move. Don't go away. I'll be back. There's even one of the commentaries who says, why does Avram rush through everything? By Yimaher, and he ran into this. Why is he rushing? Because he's got God waiting. I know we like to think, why did he rush? Because that's how he did the mitzvah of Hachnasat Archim. So that's one whole way of reading it. What if it's chol, then how do you read it? Yeah, he's talking to the guest now. Look at Rashi in source 3, commenting on this Gemara. Chutz mizeh, that they're all holy except for this one instance, which is mundane. L'malach ha'emtza'i kara adon. Shekach bo lefanav, Michael be'emtza'o Gavriel miyimino v'Rifael mismolo. So if you have Michael and flanked by Gavriel and Rifael, you could get carried away and say Adonai to them, even though it is not holy in this sense, but you're speaking to very, very prominent people, or actually prominent angels who look like prominent people, and that's why Avram spoke the way they did. That's what Rashi says. The other opinion, Avzeh Kadosh, Dechtiv La'elmine, why would I say this is also holy? Because it says right before this, Vayirei Lav Hashem, that God appeared to him. The Hadr Dechtiv, and then it said, V'hinei Shlosha Anashim, and then it says three men came. V'amar L'Kadosh Baruch Hu, then he said to God, okay, Kadosh, Al na tavo me'al avadecha, please don't go away. Hamtein likan, right? He gives God one of these. He says, wait up over here. Ad she'ikanes ha'archin, till I go and take the guests inside. What's the matter? Hachnis, she'achnis ha'archin, till I take in the guests. So now, if I say it's kadosh, then I have this incredible teaching. But by the way, I still have a problem. What's the problem? Special.
I just the
then he starts running and taking care of them.
No more dialogue
with God. The next things is he's running and he's baking and giving orders and bringing and the Avram's tent. Maybe. And that's one of the points of intrigue. We have no evidence of that. We have no indication, because if he thought they were their people, if he thought they were angels, why give them food? It's sort of like a waste.
To do the right thing, even if they don't want to eat.
The Gemara says, how do you know? You know, we call the phrase, one in Rome. How do you know you always follow them in Hag HaMakom? So it says, when the angels came to Avram, they ate. On the other hand, when Moshe went up to heaven, he didn't eat. So therefore you learn, you always follow whatever the local custom is. I say that with limitations. It may depend where you visit, okay? By the way, there's a whole nother intrigue over here, which I'll explain a little bit, and then we'll come back to Hachnasat Archin. If we go back now to Rashi in source number 5, this is Rashi on the Rashi in the Chumash, which, till this point, you may not have realized that Rashi is pointing out something complicated, and this is what he has right, and what he has right in front of him is all the sources I just now read to you. Rashi in on the Chumash says, "Vayomer again, Aleph Dalad Nun Yud Imna Ligadol Shebehem Amar." So, what did Rashi just now say? Which opinion did Rashi just now follow? Rashi is saying that it's chol. See, according to Rashi, till this point, he's going to have a problem. What's his problem? His problem is still going to be that God came, so why did God come? So how does Rashi finesse around this whole problem? Why did God come? So if God came, he didn't tell him anything, so why did he come? Just to be there, just to visit him. Now, why would God just visit him if there's no purpose to it? So what does Rashi then say? He says something brilliant. Look at the end of last week's parasha. What's the last thing that happened? That Avram had a brit milah. So why is God coming to visit him? Bikur cholim. Meaning, the point of the revelation is bikur cholim. Now, what forced Rashi to say that? Because there's a revelation without any content. So that's why Rashi comes and says, oh, it's bikur cholim. And then he further says, well, at this point, Avram doesn't feel that well. Why doesn't he feel well? Because he's 99 years old and he just had a self-inflicted circumcision. So if he doesn't feel that well, Avraham normally would be running around to get guests or to bring people in, and God made it a very hot day so that nobody should bother him. Right? And that's why it said in the previous verse, he's sitting by the tent in the heat of the day. So sort of, since it's the heat of the day, there's nobody outside. But then when God comes to visit Avraham, he sees how upset he is, being that there's no visitors. So therefore, he sends these visitors over so that Avraham can go and take visitors in. Now, all of that, it doesn't say in the Chumash. Rashi just now created a whole narrative of what it doesn't say. And what motivates Rashi's narrative? The fact that it says that there is a revelation without a content. So Rashi concludes it must be just to visit him with no other purpose. Good? Rashi then continues over here and says, or starts to say at least, he says, L'gadol shebehem, in source 5, he says to the most significant of them, V'karem kulam adonim, and he calls them all adonim, u'l'gadol amar al na ta'avor. So he's bothered by your problem of the switching from the adoni, or adonai, which would be plural, to the al na ta'avor, which is singular. So that's how Rashi's trying to, again, to finesse that point over here. So don't worry, Rashi was also aware of what we've noticed. V'kevan shaloy avor hu yamdu chaveravimo v'loshon ze hu chol. And according to this approach, it is mundane. But Rashi doesn't stop there. He says, davar acher, but if you want, there's another approach. And what's the other approach? Kadosh hu. V'hoya omer l'kadosh baruch hu lahamtin lo ad shiruts v'yachnis et ta'orchin. There's another approach. You can say it's holy, and he's telling God to wait until he is machnis orchim. Now, as a side point, we have something very interesting which the Ramban is going to tell us. But before I get to this Ramban, I've been teaching for the last at least, 18 years, 19 years, a class in Bar Ilan University on Agadah. Remember? And one of the things which is invariably asked multiple times during the year is we read an unbelievable Agadah. So what will somebody say? Is this true? So my answer will be, always, I mean, I can't give them a simple answer because that would make them happy. So my answer inevitably is, yes, it's true. The only question is if it happened. Do you like that answer or you don't like that answer so much? Did it happen? Yeah. I said it's true. The only question is if it happened or not. I didn't say that. I said it's true. You're right. I'll agree with you. But is it true? Now, one of the, if I have time and I'm in the mood, one of the great ways of illustrating that is by what the Ramban quotes over here. And he hates it. This bothers the Ramban so much. But again, it goes around the same point over here. The Ramban quotes the Rambam. Which is such a funny thing for him to do, and it must be, that the Rambam was well known and well read during that time. This is something the Rambam wrote in the Guide for the Perplexed. I'm pretty convinced that had the Ramban not written this and attacked it, most people never would have seen it today, because it's today the Guide for the Perplexed is pretty much an obscure source. He quotes and he says, "V'sefer mor nevuchim nemar kol ki aparsha klal uprat amarakot of tchila ki nira elav Hashem b'marat nevua ve'echaita hamara hazot ki nasa inav b'marav hinei shlosha nashim nitzavim alav." And I'll explain to you in a second what it is that he says, but he does not like this at all, and he goes and spends the rest of the time over here attacking it. What he says, the Rambam understands, is a klal uprat. Now, you may be familiar with those words, klal uprat. What does a klal mean? A general teaching. What is a prat? A specific teaching. So instead of quoting the Ramban, quoting the Rambam, attacking the Rambam, let's read the Rambam, and then if you want to, you can attack, or you can say, wow, that's very interesting. The Rambam is basing himself on source number 7, Vayomer, again, Adonai, Imna Matzatichein, Tani Rabchia. Rabchia taught, Ligodol Shebehen Amar, Ze Michael. He said this to the greatest of them, who was Michael. Yikach nam atmayim, and then so on, he continues. So who is it that he speaks to? To Michael, which is something you're already familiar with. We'll read the Rambam in English, because I saw no reason to prefer the Arabic original. Well, Arabic original we could have read, except for two problems. One, I can't read it, and two, most likely you don't understand it. So then we could have read the Hebrew translation, but I don't know why the Hebrew translation would be preferable to the English translation, so we'll just read straight the English translation. Guide for the Perplexed, Book 2, chapter 42. This important principle was adopted by one of our sages, one of the most distinguished among the Reb Chiya the Great, Reb Chiya HaGadol. In the exposition of the scriptural passage commencing, and the Lord appeared unto him in the plain of Mamre, the general statement that the Lord appeared to Avram is followed by the description in what manner the appearance of the Lord took place. Namely, Avram saw first three men, he ran and spoke to them. Reb Chiya, the author of the explanation, holds that the words of Avram, my Lord, if now I have found grace in thy sight, do not, I pray thee, pass from my servant, were spoken by him in prophetic vision to one of the men. For he says that Avram addressed these words to the chief of these men. Note this well, for it is one of the great mysteries of the law. He then continues to say the same thing is true with when Yaakov wrestles with that mysterious man. That was an angel. Circumstances are here exactly the same as those in the vision of Avram, where the general statement, the Lord appeared, is followed by the detailed description. Should I explain to you what he just now said in English or something very close to it? Go back to the first source. Vayar elav Hashem bolenei mamre v'hu yashiv petach ol tichom hayom. What did the Rambam say that is? That's a klal. What does it mean by that's the klal? That's the general thing of what happened. What does this mean? And it happened that God appeared to Avram. Does that mean that God walked into the tent? Avram, how are you feeling and what's going on and so on? No. What does it mean? What is the content of the revelation according to the Rambam? The next verse. Well, I'm getting back to the point of it. Did this happen or not? According to the Rambam, this was a prophetic vision. Which means if you would have satellite photographs of Avraham's tent 4,000 years ago, you would see that Avraham never got up that day. Which goes back to the point that this is that the story is completely true. The only question is if it happened. Why? Which means the truth is the fact that God revealed himself to him. He's saying that the way that God revealed is through these perceived three people who actually later on in the vision, it becomes clear that they're angels. The Ramban goes crazy. He goes, and Sarah laughed in her heart in the middle of Avraham's dream. Like he says, like, and when does he wake up? Hopefully before Mount Sinai takes place. Which he doesn't say that, but I'm saying that. But the Ramban is very, very troubled by this whole approach. The Rambam thinks it's wonderful. And by the way, when you read the verses, it's not such a bad claim as far as the verses go, because you have a problem. What's the problem? Right. Now the truth is, if you follow this approach... What do you mean? Yeah, this is... Right. All this is part of the vision. He never got up. Yes? Right, or Shlomo Kalbach, who sees Eliyahu HaNavi wherever he looks, or but my question to you is: are you telling me what you think? Or are you telling me what the Rambam thinks?
It's possible that
no, that's not what he says. The Rambam says,
it is a prophetic
vision. Yeah, the Rambam says it very clearly. You read it back again. He says that this was a prophetic vision, and he thinks this is a great secret of the Torah. This is a wonderful thing to know. I mean, he says it quite clearly. No, am I imagining that? It says, the word spoken by him in a prophetic vision to one of the men. In a prophetic vision. The Rambam believes that this is all part of a prophecy. By the way, if you follow the Rambam now, then what happens to all of our wonderful teaching about the importance of Achnasat Archim? you throw it all away. Right? According to the Rambam, you can't even start now. That whole wonderful teaching, it's gone.
Now,
it's not gone. No. The importance of Hachnasat Archim could be here, but not that it's greater than Pnei Hashchinah. That's no longer here because that whole scene didn't take place. So as I said, the Ramban quotes the Rambam here. He attacks him. He gets all upset with him. Can I point out something which I find real interesting? I will anyway. That source, not anything. That source 11. This is what the Rambam himself writes. in terms of the laws of Hachnasat Archim. Source 11, the Rambam in Hichot Avel, Perik Yudalad Al-Chabet, Schar HaLevaya, it's not Levaya, HaLevaya, Merubeh Min HaKol, V'hu HaChok Shechok, Levaya means to accompany the person once you do Hachnasat Archim. V'hu HaChok Shechok Ku Avram Avinu V'derech HaChesed Shenahagba, and this is the teaching that Avram taught. This is the practice of chesed that Avram did. Ma'achil ovrei drachim, to feed people who are traveling along the way. U'mashke otan, u'milave otan, to give them food, to give them drink, and to accompany them. U'gdola hachnasat archim, ne'hakabalat p'nei ashkina. Oh, look at this. The Rambam does take this teaching. Now, you look at the verse that he quotes. Shenemar v'yar v'hinei shlosha nashim. For it says that he looks and he sees three men. Now, that's not the verse the Gemara quoted. Yes or no? The Gemara quoted the next. Right, right. And he writes, Levayam yoter mehachnasatan, amru chachamim, kosheinim alavek, ilu shofech damim, which we're not going to get into today. The Rambam really stresses the importance of also accompanying somebody outside of the house afterwards. But let me point out something else interesting in the Rambam, and this is source 12. Kol hashemot ha'amurim ba'avraham, Kadosh, af zeshenemar, Adonai imna matzati chein harehu kadosh. So what's the Rambam's conclusion?
I think he's mixed up and different times of his life.
Good guess. He wrote them at the same times. The Rambam was writing to two different audiences. When the Rambam wrote his halacha book, the Mishnah Torah, he wrote A, that the name Aleph Dalet Nun Yud in this case is kadosh. If it's Kadosh, which opinion in the Gemara is he following? The opinion that ends up with the importance of Hachnasat Archim even more than Kabbalat Pnei Ashkina. And when he writes the laws in Hichot Avel, he also quotes it, but what's very strange to me is that he quotes another verse. It's not so strange, because the Rambam very often will teach a law and not quote the same verse that the Gemara quotes. I think the reason he does it is that sometimes he thinks the verse that he quotes is easier to understand. He's not trying to prove a point. This is how you learn it from. He's trying to show how you see something. But I'm not going to go any further into the logic or the inner logic of the Rambam. I'm just pointing out that the Rambam very clearly comes to the conclusion that this is Kadosh, which absolutely contradicts what he wrote in the Moron Uvruchim. In case you're concerned, in the Guide for the Perplexed, the Moron Uvruchim, which he wrote for a broad audience, or really for a philosophical audience, where he tries to defend Judaism, and I think that he says things which he thinks are possible. He wrote this between the age of 50 and 60, around, and he writes the Mishnah Torah at around the same time. I mean, again, he's editing it over a period of years, but around the same time he's writing the Mishnah Torah. So it's not that he's not aware what he wrote in the other place. And by the way, he had another tool that he could have used. Subsequent editions that came out during his lifetime, he could have changed things and fixed them. No, he wrote two different things. Which means if you'd ask the Rambam what he thinks philosophically about something, he'll give one answer. If you ask him law, legally, what he thinks about something, he'll give another answer, which I think it's fascinating. But the Ramban went and convinced all kinds of people what the Rambam believed. I'm not convinced that the Rambam believed what he wrote. I know that sounds terrible, but I think that the Rambam wrote a book for a mass audience, and he presented Judaism in terms of a possible understanding. Over here, he wasn't making something up. This is what Reb Chiya said. He said, I'm going to tell you what Reb Chiya said, and I want you to understand philosophically the implications of what Reb Chiya said. I think there's a great teaching involved in this. But when it came down to the Rambam himself, when the laws of writing a Sefer Torah, if you would ask the Rambam, when you write this word in the Sefer Torah, if the Sofer would not have in mind, he's writing the name of God over here, again, I'm pretty sure, according to the Rambam, the Torah would not be kosher. That according to the Rambam, this is the name of God, and you need to have intention of the name of God. It should be written that way, and it should be read that way, and that's the way it should be taught. On the other hand, he himself taught a different way. Of course, it was a different audience. He taught different things. Does this bother you? If it bothers you, I'm sorry. But is it interesting? You didn't you all know that rabbis say different things to different people? Yes. So now you see. So now you see it.
The I don't
know what to tell you. I don't know what to tell you. You see that he should have said it the other way around. The Mishnah Torah is a book, well, that's also interesting. The Mishnah Torah is, he thinks, is a book for the masses, but it's a halacha book. But I think he wrote it for people that were within the tradition to make learning Torah easy. The Mora Nevuchim, I believe he wrote for people who are today what you would call people who are off the derech, on the way to off the derech, or people that he has to explain Judaism in a more flowery, philosophical way. So I don't know if to call that masses or not. But over here, it's very interesting because he says two different things. Okay, again, this is not the only time he contradicts himself, although it's interesting, a number of the times that the Ramban attacks him for things that he said, he attacks him for what he says in the Mora Nevuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed. Then you go back and look what the Ramban wrote in the Mishnah Torah, says the same thing as the Ramban. So, and the Ramban knew that. So apparently the Mora Nevuchim had a large audience, and the Ramban didn't like what he wrote in those places. The question is if the Rambam liked what he wrote in those places. And if you really want to do homework, go back and read his introduction to the Guide for the Perplexed. He seems to disassociate himself from a lot of things that he says. He says, I'm writing this for a particular reason, and if you knew what it was, you would understand. And like he really does apologize a bit for it. But again, let the scholars decide what the real Rambam is. I mean, I would, the way I was taught, the real Rambam is what he says in his halacha book. As I said, that's the real Rambam. Obviously, people can disagree. Yeah.
Couldn't there be a line? He says,
No, no, there it's chol. There he says it's chol.
What?
There he's quoting Reb Chiya, who says it's chol, that he's saying it to the person.
Okay.
You can't... If it'll make you happy, I'll say yes. What Marion wants to say is that maybe that within the dream, he really realizes that this angel is a messenger of God, and therefore he knows that God is really pulling the strings behind the messenger. So he's talking to the angel, but he's really saying God.
And the message is that Hakadosh Baruch Hu is what God wants.
Right. It could be, even though that doesn't come at all in the Mora Nevuchim, that gets pushed aside completely. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that his father once caught him reading the Guide for the Perplexed. And I think the way he told the story, his father hit him, but at least he took the book away from him and said to him, this is only for somebody who's perplexed. That somebody who's not perplexed should not be reading this book. Okay, so as I said, again, you can, so therefore my bias as far as which is the more important which is the true
Rabbi. Why does it help the perplexed to know that it's similar?
I think that we would all, and I understand that's bothered you last time you asked something a little different. I think that what we need to do is to understand Islamic philosophy and what the people were reading, what they were believing at that particular time, and Greek philosophy, because that's really what he's trying to write. He's writing a philosophical work. Why this would have been more, you know, acceptable to the people, I can't answer you. I'm just pointing out that if you read the Ramban here, you're convinced of what the Rambam says without anybody pointing out in a footnote, by the way, that's not what the Rambam himself writes in his actually much more famous book. What I want to try to do for the rest of today is to get to the halacha itself and say, yeah, hold it, is this true? Is this true that Hachnasat Urchin, or Urchim, is more important than Kabbalat Pnei HaShchinah? So, I mean, sometimes, here, for example, let's say somebody comes to visit me, and this is more of a male-oriented question. If you're limited to davening within a particular time, or the local minyan will only be at a particular time, and I just have a guest come in, so should I now say taking care of the guest is more important than davening, or more important than davening with a minyan? What would you say? Okay, Pnei HaShchinah. Or Hachnasat Archim. So there you go. Here's this wonderful teaching, this wonderful idea, how important Hachnasat Archim. So is that really true? So what would the answer be? What? So you want to look at the source, the answer 22. You read it, you skipped all the way to there. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was asked this. This does not appear in any of his writings. It's rather in a book about tefillah. I think it's called Tefillah Kilchata. And I'm quoting only a couple lines. I mean, Shapir Mistaber does see Shachnasar Achim Chashiv Tfei Mitfilah Bitzibur, that it's more important to take care of the guest than daven with a tzibur. And by the way, that's assuming that you can't do both. Achim einu mimaher v'gam barur shlo yipaga. If the guy, the question which was asked to him, what if you're going to miss tefillah b'tzibur? And he says, if you're not, if the guest isn't hurrying and he's not going to be insulted, yesh lomer lo b'derech kavod shetzarich lelechet litpalel. You should say to the guest, with respect, that you need to pray, v'yivakshenu lahamtin ad sheyashuv, and ask him if he can still stay, please stay till you come back. And obviously what Shlomo Zalman is saying is,
or come
alone. But what he's saying is, and let's say he can't or he won't, then he's saying that taking care of your guest is more important. I mean, he's saying that, again, assuming he won't be insulted, assuming that, you see that he's working very hard to create a situation, because what does Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach really believe? He believes that it's more important to take care of the guests. Now, part of the question would be why this would be. So I'll just quote a couple of things in terms of the significance of the mitzvah. Look at source 13. Rabbi Yochanan v'Reish Lakish, da'amri t'revayhu, they both said, bizman shebeit ha-mikdash kayam mizbeach mechaper al adam. When there was a temple, then the mizbeach would bring people forgiveness. Achshav shulchano shel adam mechaper alav. And now a person's table, your table takes the place of the mizbeach. So how does your table take the place? I mean, I don't know what your food looks like, if it looks like burnt offerings or not. Rashi explains in source 14, shulchano mechaper alav behachnasat orchin. That this idea that your table brings about forgiveness or some kind of a holy thing, or you get back to this as if pnei hashchinah, because bringing guests around your table is considered to be as if it were bringing a sacrifice. In source 15, the Maharsha comments, "V'nira lefareish devaday in lenot mishel acherim ela dehacha bigdola mitzvat hachnasat erchin shehi hagdola bigmilut chasadim." So he says a couple of things which are interesting here. One is that he's saying that hachnasat erchin fits into the category of gemilut chasadim. What is gemilut chasadim? To do the kind acts of kindness. There is a whole debate whether this is a Torah law or rabbinic law. It could very well be the specific commandment of hachnasat erchin is rabbinic, but when one does hachnasat erchin, one fulfills the Torah law of at least v'ahavta racha kamocha and perhaps other laws as well. There is a wonderful book which is called Ahavat Chesed. If you've never heard of it, it's written by a man who you know as the Chafetz Chaim. I have a copy with very little letters over here, but there, I'm 99% sure that it's available in English and Hebrew. And this is the classic book on all Chesed, on all Gemilut Chesedim, and he has an entire chapter over here that deals with Hachnasat Erchim, with all kinds of laws and more than just laws in it. In source 16, he writes, "Da, you should know, to gemilut chasadim begufo kolel kol hadvarim she'adam meitiv l'chaveiro ayedei shematriach gufo l'zeh." That gemilut chasadim. What is gemilut chasadim? When we say gemilut chasadim, what does that mean? All things that you do with your person to help somebody else. V'hu achnasat orchin shemitvato hu shehishtadlut odotam lekablam bepanim yafot afilum einam tzrichin l'tovato. I mean, there's a whole question if gemilut chasadim can be performed to somebody who's, let's say, wealthy and doesn't need your meal, doesn't need it. He goes, no, absolutely. Anything that you do to help somebody else, including, he says, achnasat erchin, this is part of gemilut chasadim. Then he continues, says, ubikur cholim, mesameh chatan v'kala, v'levayat tamet, v'kvurto, v'hespedo, v'nesiyat mitato, v'od kama, v'chama inyanim. That all these things fit into gemilut chasadim. Gemilut chasadim is what you do in order to help another person. The Rambam says that the verse that you learned this out from, as I said in passing, is the verse of the Avta L'Reacha Kamocha. Yeah, there is a question which is brought up. So let's say by the laws of tzedakah. This is a very sad law. If somebody comes over to you and says, can you give me money? I need money for tzedakah. And you give it to them. They didn't need it. You did not fulfill the mitzvah of tzedakah. Okay? On the other hand, hachnasat erchin does not make a difference if the person needs it or not. which means somebody could be the wealthiest person, but they walk into your door, you treat them with honor and respect, you do the mitzvah of hachnasat orchin. Okay, right? It's not even a question. Correct, correct. And that, correct, and that is the fulfillment, that's what he writes here, it's the fulfillment of mitzvah of hachnasat orchin, which is a mitzvah of gimlut chasadim, which is a fulfillment of v'haftarecha kamocha. You fulfill the mitzvah. There's a very interesting book, very strange book, but very interesting. I hope he wouldn't mind me saying strange. And I know the author actually wrote me a very nice hakdasha over here. It's called Sefer Habayit. I don't know if any of you have homes and you've been without this book till now. I don't know how. It is everything you'd ever want to know about your home. He calls it, and there's a picture of a house you'll appreciate in the front over there. Otsir dinimu min hagim, hakshirim lebayit v'han hagato. B'niyat habayit u'mikumo, zmanei rechishato, azharot rabbeinu Yehuda al-chassid, dinei mezuzah u'ma'akeh, zeich l'churban, brichot shechiyanu, v'atov v'meitiv, hachnasat orchim, dinei habayit b'shabat u'v'modei ha'shana, seder chanukat habayit u'tfilatam, al minhagav hashonim, uvesofo nidfa sefer raziel hamalach. All of this collected by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Lerner, who wrote other books. One of them is called Shmirat Hagufa HaNefesh. Every single superstition that you've ever heard in your life is there in that book. He collected them all in one place in two volumes called Sefer Shmirat Hagufa HaNefesh. And this book does have all those things he just now said, including a significant chapter on hachnasat orchim, and all these kinds of questions come up over here. And if anybody is interested, it is, he has lots of footnotes, everything is here. Although my guess is that a good percentage of what he has here you can find in the Chafetz Chaim beforehand, in not as orderly, but it's all there in the Chafetz Chaim in Ahavat Chesed. I'll come back to something here in a moment. Yes.
About staka.
Yes.
You gave, but they didn't need it. In other words, they didn't need it because they were using it like for drugs or something.
They didn't need it
because they were tricking you.
They didn't need it because they're wealthier than you are, and they made themselves off to be something they're not. I know.
So if you're walking on the street and somebody wants a handout.
I would advise when walking on the street to people like that, you should give and give a minimal amount of money. And if you have a substantial amount of money to give, then do a bit of research and say, okay, where is a good place for me to give this money to? And you should look at this the same way as if you have money to invest, right? I mean, I don't know if any of you have investing strategies. I don't know if any of you have investing strategies. She gets away with it because we live together. And it seems that my children only call between 9 and 10 on Thursdays. They'll never call any other time. So I would say like an investment strategy should be if you have a lot of money to invest, so you're going to look for the best possible investment that you have, and that's what you're going to put your money into. And that's how you should look at staka as well. On the other hand, there is an obligation to give money if a Jew is asking for it. But I would say that to those people that you don't know anything about it, so you should give them. There was a story when I was in YU. There was a woman who would always come around and ask me for money, and there are rumors around that she would get driven there by a limousine and go back in a limousine. You know this story. You know this woman. Okay, I'll comment on that in a second. Let me first tell you.
Very interesting. And then they all went into this car again. I guess they went to play someone else.
Okay, slow down. Let me comment on that, but first I want to tell you the story about this old woman. Apparently, somebody looked into it at one point. I think one of the rabbis looked into it, and apparently what happened is that this woman, she had lived in absolute poverty during the Depression, and when she got a little bit older, she was convinced that she was going to be very poor. On the other hand, her husband had left her money, and her son was a very, very successful man. And he said, you don't need to collect money. I will give you everything you need. But she wouldn't listen to him. So she had this psychological need to go around collecting money. And he said, at least let my driver take you there. It's a dangerous neighborhood. And let my driver wait for you and take you home afterwards. So I'm saying, so now what do you do with this woman? So she has a need for money, a need to collect. So I would not then say, oh, listen, I've been saving money for a year to give to some institution. I'm going to give it to her. No. But you play the game and you give a minimal amount. And that's what I think should be done in situations like this. I do know that there are people, I know in various places in Chutz La'aretz, for sure, I assume it happens here as well, that there are people who will take a percentage of the money which is raised, and they'll tell the people that are collecting, come with me, I will take you to the right places, and that's exactly what they do. They take three or four of them at once. He takes them to the right homes, and then he will take a percentage back for his...
Ten on a Sunday.
Same driver. Okay. You got to pay him more money to stop coming to you. I'll give you $10 not to come here. Okay, let's continue.
The
money which is meaning if the person really needed it on the street, then it does count. If they didn't need it, then it doesn't count. So I can't tell you what count. That's why I'm saying when.
And if you don't know.
And that's why I'm saying is that. Give tzedakah responsibly. Is that an irresponsible thing for me to say?
Like a Malki Israel?
Yeah. Let's continue. The Shulchan Aruch in source 17, it's talking about the laws of Shabbat, which are called shvut. Shvut are generally things which are not prohibited on a Torah level, but those are the kinds of things that you would say are not within the spirit of Shabbat. These are things which are generally prohibited on a rabbinic level. Okay? Over here it says, V'chol shvut shehitiru mishum tzarech mitzvah, Mutar l'tzarech orchin. Now, let me explain what that means. The rabbis say not to do a particular act on Shabbat. But they also say that if there is a mitzvah to be involved in this, then you can do that shvut. For example, this may not be a great example, but just to get an idea of this, it would be a problem not on a Torah level, on a rabbinic level, it would be a problem to tell a non-Jew to put lights on Shabbat for you. Right? That would be a problem on a rabbinic level to ask him to do it. On the other hand, what if it is in the shul and they can't read the Torah because it's too dark inside, or they can't daven because it's too dark? That would be litzarech mitzvah. So anything which is not allowed on a rabbinic level, that rabbinic level doesn't count where it's litzarech mitzvah. Over here, the Shulchan Aruch writes, v'kol shvut shiyitir mishum tzarech mitzvah, mutar litzarech orchim. Anything which is not allowed because of a shvut, which is, again, a lower-level Shabbat law, is allowed for the sake of guests. Source 18, the Mishnah Berurah explains, Shebalabayit hamazminam osem mitzvah, because this is also tzarech mitzvah, because the hosts who invites them fulfills a mitzvah, kimosha amru chazal degdola hachnasat archim yoter mekabalat pnei hashchina. So again, he didn't have to quote that. But the Mishnah Berurah is quoting this in order to show you that having the guests, you are fulfilling a mitzvah to the extent that that would end up trumping or outweighing this idea of a shvut. And again, in order to know exactly what the practical halacha ramifications of this, I would have to teach the laws of shvut inside. If you want, we can do that. But I'm just saying here, I'm just teaching this in theory without knowing what you just now gained from this particular law. Source 19 says, is a law which in the laws of eating. And within the laws of eating, it tells us something which applies to hachnasat orchin. And here it says, lo yitain la'ochel le'echol, don't give someone to eat, elo lemi sheyodeya bo sheyivarech, you're only allowed to give food to somebody who you will know will make a bracha. Then he writes, v'yesh mekilim inotein la'ani b'torat staka. Now we're back to tztaka again. But some say you're allowed to do it. If you give it to somebody poor, you give it to him tztaka. So what does that mean? When the poor person comes into your house to eat, you invite him for a meal, you know he's not going to make a bracha, but you give him the food, and what you're doing is you're giving him tztaka. So this goes back to your question before about intention. Over here, your intention is that you're giving him tztaka. So what does it mean you're giving him tztaka? You gave him a gift. What's the problem with all this? The problem is really one of lifnei iver lo titein michshol, of putting a stumbling block in front of a blind person. The Mishnah Brura qualifies.
I have a good neighbor across the hall. They're not religious, and I give them Mishloach Manot each year.
So I'm sure there are people who would be upset with you, but look at source 20. Vidafka imitoch rishato, only if because of wickedness they don't make a bracha. Vel imitoch onso, she'enu yachol levarech, lo nafka mitzvat staka b'shvil zeh. So, which means he limits this and says this is only going to be true if you give the tzedakah, but even the tzedakah is only true if the person is not making the bracha because of they don't know how. How you would treat non-religious today is important, and maybe I will come back. Maybe I will have at least one or two classes on that. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes in a tshuva about this, source 21. Harot binyan isur lifnei iver. He writes kibud ba'achila v'shtiyah l'misha yodea shelo yivarech. And he gives a particular case. You have an important guest, who is not religious, but still he has love or respect. And not only that, he makes the case more interesting. It may be somebody who's a donor. If the homeowner won't treat him with respect but give him food or drink, according to halacha, you're only allowed to give food to somebody who you know is going to make a bracha. And even if respectfully you ask him to wash his hands to make a bracha, it's going to look like an insult to the person's honor. It can get the person very upset. And that if you treat him this way, he may move even further from the Torah. And he's going to hate and be mad and hate all people that go on the path of Torah. In such a case, I thought, that you should give him food and drink, and not to be worried about this problem of putting a stumbling block in front of a blind person. Even though you don't ask someone to break a small commandment so that someone else won't break a big commandment, which means you would be breaking a small command by giving the food, right? But he's saying is even though we don't tell someone to do that, gives other examples. Nonetheless, in this case, the whole problem over here is you're putting a stumbling block. But if you don't give him food, then you're putting a bigger stumbling block in front of him. How so? If you don't give him food, what's the bigger stumbling block? Then you're going to bring him further. Well, you're going to let him come to the conclusion, look how terrible religious Jews are. So Rav Shlomo Zalman concludes, this is fascinating, because he concludes that when you look at something like Lifnei Iver, putting a stumbling block in somebody, he says, well, look at the macro situation and not at the micro thing. So I'll go back to your neighbor, because I think that this applies to many interpersonal relationships. And certainly regarding the whole idea of a chnasat erchim, it certainly applies. But It could be. And I was thinking that this is such an interesting use of that hachnasat erchim is more important than lakabel pnei hashchina, even though he's not using that phrase over here, because really what's being trampled upon, the guy's not making a bracha. And that's in a sense this pnei hashchina. On the other hand, by you not treating him nicely, you are doing a worse lifnei iver. So he says if that's the case, you're certainly allowed, or you should give the persons in your house and visiting you, you certainly should give them food. And look, based on this tshuva, I would not necessarily say in all cases, in all situations, across the board, one should give food to somebody who's not religious. But what this does do is it creates a very important heter, which I think will apply in many, many cases. Okay, okay, I'm saying, I said, I'm afraid to say every case. I don't know. It doesn't always mean you should put yourself into that situation. Okay? Okay, I'll answer that, but not today. Okay, I'll answer that not today. But you realize Rav Shlomo Zalman is being very, very clever and also very, very, you know, human in his response over here and saying, don't, what he's saying is don't bother me with micro issues. Sometimes you need to learn how to be a much broader thinker. Yeah.
Why would you be worried about whether a person would say it's not bothering you? Isn't that something that that's that person's relationship to Hashem, not your, it's not your problem?
Yeah. Yes, but you can't cause somebody to sin. In this case, giving them food, and you know they won't make a bracha, is causing them to sin. Let them get food someplace else. Right, but that's, but you're causing them. That's the problem. That's the case in the Shulchan Aruch. Durabanan. Wait, one second. The bracha is Durabanan, but the bracha would be Durabanan. Right. It's limited. Right. Durabanan. I want to bring one more story in, which is in this book, which I'd heard before, and I was pretty sure that he had it over here in a footnote. This is on page 461. It says as follows, Hagon Reb Leib Chasmin Zatzal Sa'ad Pam. Reb Leib Chasmin once had dinner Bilel Shabbat Al Shulchano Shabal HaChafetz Chaim B'Radin. He visited the Chafetz Chaim in Radin, and he was there for Friday night dinner. Kishabo mitfila bebeit haKnesset, when he came home from davening, Tamar Reb Leib Lerot, he was shocked to see Shachavetz Chaim lo amar shalom aleichem kinahug. He didn't say shalom aleichem. It's bad enough I don't say eshet chayil, but he didn't say shalom aleichem. Ela miyad kidesh alayayin. Immediately, he said kiddush. Natalia dav l'suda, and after saying kiddush, he washed. V'achalat hadagim, and ate some fish. V'racha acharei achilat hadagim, hitchilom or shalom aleichem. Then he started to say shalom aleichem. Sha'al Reb Leib l'marana chafetz chaim. Reb Leib asked him, Mara amar l'shanot miminaga mukubal. What was it that caused you to go against the normal custom? Yeshivlo achafetz chaim b'chiyuch. These things always get embellished, but I guess. It says that he answered with a smile, Harei kfodo b'vaday haya ra'ev. He said, you were certainly hungry. V'ritziti le'hasido t'chila, and I wanted to feed you first. V'ilu ha'malachim einam ra'avim. The angels, which takes us all the way back to the beginning with our angels, the angels aren't hungry. B'cholim l'hamtim kim'a im ha'shalom aleichem. And they're able to wait a little bit until they get their shalom aleichem. So again, I thought this was such a beautiful story. First of all, it tells you a lot about the Chafetz Chaim, but it's also, it's exactly, hachnasat archim is more important than kabbalat pnei hashchina, or in this case, more important than kabbalat, right? Kabbalat Shabbat in the sense of kabbalah of the malachim is what shalom aleichem is all about. So I thought it was a real, like, poetic justice that we started the whole thing. We understood because of Avraham's taking in the angels and giving them to eat. So over here we have this wonderful story of the Chafetz Chaim that we really do end up concluding this lahalacha, and we see various applications of this, that hachnasat archim is more important than kabbalat pnei shchina. Other applications that come up, he writes about in Avad Chesed, which is slightly different, but in terms of, let's say, somebody has to go and learn, and we say, gimilut chasadim, these are the things that are karen kayemet lo, and so on, and then what does it say at the end? V'talmud Torah keneged kulam. So what's more important? I can say the Talmud Torah is more important. So, and there will be people that will go back and forth on this, but over here we also find the Chafetz Chaim saying that I have to go off and learn someplace, but guests come in. So what's more important? Is it more important to take care of guests? Or no, I have to learn right now. So he comes and says, no, taking care of the guests is more important. And that's really what we end up concluding from this case. So let's just go back. I wasted your time in the beginning showing you this whole thing with the Kodesh and Chol and what the name means, because it does make a difference in learning out this particular law. The Rambam, who ended up so far afield from the whole thing and said the whole thing was a dream and he never spoke to God in the whole thing was Chol and the Ramban attacked him for it, what did he end up saying? That the Rambam quotes the same law, and the Rambam also says that it's Kadosh, and it comes off that universally people accept this principle, that having guests and taking care of guests is trumps, or is more important than Kabbalat Pnei Hashchina. So the particular case may come in. I did see people say, for example, let's go back to davening, because there's Omachloket if davening is the right to Drabanan. I did see, for example, with davening, that if I was busy taking care of a guest and I couldn't daven at all, and say, miss Sof Zman Tefillah, I just missed the davening completely. So now, can I daven the next one twice? The general rule is, if you forget to daven, right? You forget to daven, then you can say the next tefillah twice. So they say, no, you were at this point you had no choice. You had to take care of the other person, so you can't say tefillah. You can't say the tefillah twice afterwards. I'm not sure if that's quite a case. What? I know. So that's the other side. Because if you say Osek mitzvah patur mitzvah, then you shouldn't have to make it up. Then you're patur lagamrei. Then you shouldn't have to make it up.
If your guests arrive erev Shabbat late,
yeah.
Should you push off candle lighting to welcome them in and set them up?
Well, candle lighting is also not a. Yeah, we'll have to find the exact, and that's why I'm afraid of just saying across the board, but we do find that people are taking this quite seriously. We saw in the Shulchan Aruch, where did the Mishnah Berurah bring this lahalacha? In the case of Shvut, in the case of a rabbinic law, that this would outweigh a rabbinic law on Shabbat, and therefore anything, as we saw before, the B'makom Mitzvah, this is all considered to be a mitzvah. Are there many, many, many more specifics involved in the laws of Hachnasa Terchim? Yes. Initially, when I thought about the topic, I thought I would go through those, but I decided that would be boring. It's boring just to go through lists of things. If you want, you can get this book, or you can get this book, or you can...
Is it an Aveira
to... to what?
To do something before you do Hachnasa Terchim. It's not a mitzvah, but is it...
I don't know what it means before. Say to an Oreach... To say,
it's coming, and you say, 1 minute, I'm going to stop.
It depends on this particular circumstance, if the person will then leave because, or the person will then stay and understand. So that's what the case where he said that you should go to shul after, he says only if the person won't be heard or the person, right? Otherwise, he said very clearly that you should then take care of that individual. Yeah.
But the other person also has to be considerate of the person who's coming to visit.
Agreed, but people aren't always... There's a whole discussion here about having people that may not be ra'oi. Agreed. And not every person, right? Appropriate. And not every person should you take into the house. No, one second. I agree.
Is it deserving of the respect if he doesn't respect my way?
Right. I'll say one thing again. There's a story here also brought of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik that he would take everybody into his house, and his house was robbed more than once by his guests that he brought in. And his family would yell at him. And he would say, where does it say that Avraham, you know, had a metal detector by the, you know, checking and people coming in and coming out? He let everybody in, and that's what we need to keep on doing. Whether that's the halacha or not, I'm not going to say, but that's the way that he conducted himself. Look, if there's somebody who is an unsavory individual who you think that you or your family or your property will be possibly hurt by letting this person in the house, then you should not let that person out. Then you say, Chayecha Kodmin, your life takes precedence, and you should not put yourself in that situation. On the other hand, sometimes we all enjoy having guests, and guests are a wonderful thing, but sometimes guests are difficult, and sometimes they get on your nerves, and sometimes there is an effort involved. I think that line that we learned, that when the Beit HaMikdash stood, the Mizbeach forgave our sins, that taking care of Orchim is like bringing a korban. Is like, okay, maybe that then resonates a little bit stronger. And that guest, which is a little bit of a pain, and you still took care of them, you fulfilled a mitzvah, you emulated Avraham and Sarah, right? And hopefully you were forgiven of your sins, as if you brought a korban. So afterwards you can say thank you for the korban. Yeah.
Do you fulfill a mitzvah
You're allowed to like them. That's fine as well. That's fine as well. You're allowed to enjoy your guests also. You did not break anything if you enjoyed your guests. Ladies, Shabbat Shalom.